Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Today's segment will focus on investment considerations when it comes to China, along with a China market and macro update featuring our partners from Matthews Asia. Matthews Asia is an active manager specializing in emerging markets and Asia and has invested across the region for more than three decades. China is a meaningful part of its universe, and the team maintains a Hong Kong office to conduct on-the-ground research focused on company fundamentals and secular trends. Joining me for today's conversation, glad to welcome Andrew Maddock, a portfolio manager focused on Chinese equities at Matthews Asia. Before joining the firm in 2015, Andrew spent 15 years at Henderson Global Investors in London and Singapore, managing Asia-Pacific equities. So with that, Andrew, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you for dropping by UBS On Air and for spending some time today with our listeners and our clients. Very much looking forward to hearing your insights.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan.
So, Andrew, to set the stage a bit, since September of 2024, China's market has advanced notably. So from your perspective, what macro focuses are driving market momentum in China?
Yeah, the rally has been very aggressive, really, since sort of the latter part of September 2024. So we sort of have to put that in context, I think, in terms of the starting point. We've been through quite a lot of negative sentiment, some of it driven by domestic forces in terms of, you know, the continual restructuring of the Chinese property market and other issues in terms of the Chinese government, I think, communicating policy, to the wider audience that was better understood. We also had, obviously, a lot of trade friction going on with the US that sort of goes back quite a long way. So almost a perfect storm in terms of the starting point. And when we reference the starting point, let's just take the MSCI China as an indicator. We were at 54 in terms of a price level. Now, 54 at a price level, the first time it hit 54 was in 2007. So the starting point, I think, is important just in terms of how cheap the market was to start with. Then towards the back half of September 2024, the government sort of stepped in finally and sort of said enough's enough. They were going to put in a little bit more stimulus going forward, particularly at the provincial government level where funding was tight. And that got the market excited. You didn't need much from, like I said, the valuation point we were coming from. Then we sort of drifted off a little bit. We sort of drifted in and out until really, I think, April 2025 this year. And then the market rally really got underway. And I think the catalyst for that was, again, price. In terms of where we were coming from, but also China demonstrated that it was executing in different things, the DeepSeek moment. There was a few deals announced between Chinese and US biotech companies in terms of out-licensing. And people started to appreciate, I think, the quality of company that you could pick up in China despite these headwinds that were more macro-related. So really, since April 2025, we've sort of gone up in a steady, straight line. The trade friction between the US and China seems to have sort of calmed down a bit. As well, there's been a little bit more communication that's gone on, that seems a lot more constructive. So that also hasn't hurt the cause. So yeah, that's sort of a bit of history in terms of, the last year or so.
Okay, so now that we have a better sense for how we got to where we are today with respect to China's market environment, as we look ahead from here, what could sustain or even broaden the move in China over the next, let's say, 6 to 18 months?
Yeah, I think the big one's the property market. So, month-on-month declines in real estate prices in China broadly have been going on since July, August 2021. So, 4 years and some months, continued month-on-month declines, apart from a small pop that we had coming out of COVID. But, it also has affected, like any economy in the world, if US house prices have been going down month to month for 4 years, or Europe, you know, it does affect consumer sentiment. There's no doubt that they needed to clean up the property market. It's always been this big overhang. What we're pleased about is that, you know, the coming collapse of China associated with the property market hasn't happened. So growth has slowed, you know, considerably, but we've still got decent growth. You could argue that the quality is a little bit better these days in the terms of the development of the service side of their economy. So I think the property market's the key in terms of a broader recovery. That's what we're looking for. Very hard to put an exact point, but we are seeing advances in terms of the inventory rundown. So we obviously get to look at all the developers in China that are listed. We can see, you know, there's a noticeable reduction in the inventory they have left. So we can see progress. But I think, you know, to answer your question straight up, property, consumer sentiment attached to that would obviously broaden this move and make it more sort of convincing in the next 6 to 18 months. And, you know, a grand deal, obviously, with the US and China. Again, you know, we know that both sides are talking, but, you know, some sort of ultimate conclusion to US-China trade friction, I think would help considerably as well.
Yeah, so running with that a bit further, when you think about these geopolitical factors, U.S.-China trade policy, the relationship there, as well as the AI tech race, how are those factors shaping China's market outlook?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of points here. I think, let's sort of take the back half of the question in terms of the AI side of things. The big U.S. monopolies have been doing very well, as we know, for a very long period of time. The ability to charge up or continued to charge up, to offer additional services, to monopolize their particular area of the market has obviously benefited those U.S. companies enormously. And Asia was sort of missing out. But this cycle is a little bit different when it comes to AI in the sense that they're spending a lot more money in terms of CapEx. And a lot of that CapEx is going into North Asia and China. You know, China does produce a lot of the components and bits and pieces that go into this data center rollout. So for the first time, if you like, the Mag 7 or the bigger monopolies in China are actually benefiting China in terms of that CapEx finding its way into corporate earnings. So I think that's the first point. The second point is, you know, broad geopolitics between the US and China, we would love to see a conclusion. I think it would certainly help sentiment. But China has done a very good job in terms of insulating itself. I mean, to put it into numbers, you know, US exports as a percent of Chinese GDP is only around 3%. You know, China is the top three trading partner globally. With 157 countries. So it has done a very good job diversifying itself. I'm not downplaying the geopolitical angle and the sentiment impact, but China, in terms of trade globally, has done a good job in not just in terms of the number of countries, but also in the types of products. And the reason it's been able to do that is because it does things on such a scale, it's able to price down or cost down, if you like, very effectively. And what that opens itself up to is a lot of emerging market countries, in Africa, in Asia, Latin America, in the Oceania region. So it has been able to broaden out because of its competitive advantage in terms of scale, being able to cost down, being able to therefore export to a lot more markets globally. So I don't want to downplay the geopolitical side of things, and I'd love to see a conclusion, but I think China's done a pretty good job in terms of insulating itself from the worst-case scenario.
Now, on the other side of it, what would you identify as perhaps the key bear case risks that could derail the trajectory?
I mean, two things, really. I think, obviously, we mentioned the property market. I think that's the big thing. You know, it just drags on. That sentiment continues to drag on. But associated with that is something that's going on sort of under the hood in China, and it's part of this sort of transition they're going through, and that's trying to develop, you know, the service side of their economy. It's a natural transition for any country that's emerging, if you like, and certainly at this stage of development in China, it's important to develop the services. And that's, you know, that's anything in the US you sort of take for granted. So going away from, you know, traditional manufacturing, fixed asset investment, into more domestic consumption, things like travel, you know, even pet care services, you know, the number or types of restaurant rollout, entertainment facilities. We are seeing a move in this direction in China at a corporate level, but it needs to continue. So the bear case scenario is it just takes longer, I think, in China than you know, I would anticipate. And therefore, we don't see this, you know, earnings pick up as aggressively in the near term as what we would like. So property and then the emergence of these service sector industries, the trajectory of that, I think, you know, are sort of the risk in terms of the level of growth in China.
So from the perspective of you and your team over at Matthews Asia, when it comes to positioning, how should U.S. investors think about China over the next 6 to 18 months?
Yeah, I mean, the starting point, again, coming back to sort of right at the beginning, you know, I think the starting point is important. If we look at where we are today after the rally, you know, ex the two big constituents of the index, you know, MSCI China, if we go back to that for a reference point. So if you X out the valuations of those two stocks, which are trading at more than 100% premium to the rest of the market, we're still coming from a very good starting point for the bottom of the earnings cycle, so around 11 times. So I think that's the number one thing, is that you're not buying an expensive market at the bottom of an earnings cycle. You know, earnings in the A-share market, you know, Shanghai and Shenzhen, to put it in perspective, really haven't grown much in the last 4 or 5 years, as this overhang on property and consumer sentiment has filtered through to corporate earnings. So we haven't gone into an up cycle in terms of corporate earnings in China broadly, but we're still trading at 11 times X those two big constituents. So the starting point's good. We've been through, you know, a long correction now in Chinese real estate. We've seen the inventory run down. So there's time and patience there that may be required, but I think we may be coming to the end of that. It's very hard to put an exact date on that, but I'm confident that it is going to happen. You know, China does have earnings drivers that could also pick up alongside that. So we've mentioned consumer sentiment after 4.5 years of declines in real estate prices. There's other things that could happen with a bit more an aggressive turn in the property market. I mean, the other thing to note is that there's really good companies in China. So I know that 11 times traditionally might look, I mean, the bottom end of the range, but not cheap. But when you look at the type of company that you're buying in China, you know, you can relate to it as a US investor. You know, the food delivery, you know, the Uber of China, the Spotify of China, the e-commerce of China. You know, there's big data center rollouts going on there with AI. There's good biotech companies. So, you know, at that price, you're talking about a different type of company today than maybe you were sort of 10 years ago as well. I do think that these macro forces that were spoken about in the podcast have been an overhang, and maybe I think too big of an overhang when, again, once you look under the hood in terms of what you're buying. But that's all to sort of, you know, to play out now going forward. I think US investors should just keep those things in mind, and then look for, you know, any potential sign of, you know, that property market bottoming out. But, you know, maybe get started, and then look for that catalyst.
Well, Andrew, very generous with your time. A pleasure having you on, hearing your insights into the China market and macro landscape, and do look forward to having you back at some point. Though, I thank you again for dropping by today.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.